the heat of a hot summer day in New York and in front of an old brownstone walk-up in a mean quarter of the city. Residents discuss the stifling conditions of the weather and the affairs of the day. Street Scene by Elmer Rice, with lyrics by Langston Hughes and music by Kurt Vile, brings to us the complex daily lives of people living in their confines, in their neighborhood, as they reveal a sense of despair that hovers over their interactions. Muhlenberg College's production of Street Scene brings to us the 1929 Pulitzer Prize-winning play that still affects the heat and the controversies of this day. Our first guest today is the director of this thought-provoking production, Charles Richter. And in the second half of the show, we chat with Peterson Toscano, comedian, performance artist, and activist, who shares the heat of our conversations of this decade of climate control, and who proposes a positive solution to our solution. Peterson performs at the Regional Conference of the Citizens Climate Lobby on March 13th at 7 p.m. at Lehigh University. This is WDIY 88.1 Allentown. You are now a part of our family here on Lehigh Valley Art Salon. I remain George Miller, and along with my wife and co-host, Kate Scuffle, we now welcome Muhlenberg College founding chair of the Department of Theater and Dance and current director of Street Scene, professor, theater impresario, and good friend, Charlie Richter. How are you, Charles?
Hi, good.
Charles, we were talking about a little bit earlier, more than a play. I mean, there's a play, Street Scene, but this is really an opera.
Oh, yes.
Which is also a little bit misleading because you were saying it's an opera written for Broadway, inspired by a play.
Right. Elmer Rice wrote Street Scene in 1928. It was Rice in the 20s was, I think, known very much as a naturalist writer. He had his first major splash on the American scene was a play called The Adding Machine, which is a very stark piece about the effects of sort of automation and sort of contemporary urban work and the crushing, the way the contemporary urban life crushes the soul. It's a very, very compelling play, which still, I think, The Adding Machine still holds up really well in its depiction of how Americans allow themselves to be destroyed by their work lives. Then he went on to write Street Scene in 1928, right before the Depression hit. Mm-hmm. And it's a play that deals with life in a tenement block in Manhattan. It's extraordinary in its structure. There is a plot, but basically what it does is give us a feel for the texture of the streets and the kind of violence and domestic abuse and the kind of what happens to people when they're living in close quarters without a lot of hope. And it's a very in its time it was a really a landmark play that sort of went against sort of the standard idea of the American dream. Very very often Americans had this idea that everything is going to be all for the best in this best of all possible worlds, but with the coming of the Industrial Revolution and automation and sort of cities that were built like beehives, Rice, always the socially aware dramatist, wanted to write a piece that gave us the texture of the city and life on the streets in the city. The play won the Pulitzer Prize and was a very, very successful piece. There was a film made later on in the 1930s. And Rice went on to be a major social activist, a dramatist. He was one of the founders of the Federal Theater Project. Mm-hmm. A writer who was really sort of committed to the idea that theater artists should be working for social change and social improvement, that we're not out just to entertain, we're out to make the world a better place to live in. Then in the 1940s, following the Second World War, he began to collaborate with Kurt Vile. Kurt Vile made his reputation in Berlin in the 1920s, with such pieces as the Threepenny Opera and the Rise and Fall of the City of Mahagoni. Being an artist of the left and also being a Jewish artist, Vile was driven from Germany by Hitler. Mm-hmm. His initial famous collaboration was with Bertolt Brecht. Brecht and Vile did some astonishing work and created works that are really landmarks of the Western cultural tradition, but in fact they didn't get along very well and at all. In fact, there's a new book about them called The Partnership, which goes into great the gory details of their collaboration. So when Brecht and Weill left Germany, really quite suddenly, once Hitler came to power almost overnight, Hitler put out an enemies list of cultural figures that were bad for the German Reich, and at the top of the list were Brecht and Weill, because their works were probably the most popular musical theater works in Germany at the time. They sort of got on the boat and left. And Brecht spent years traveling around Europe, going to a variety of different European countries and working with new composers and other people, because all his pieces are musicals, in fact. But Weill decided to do something different. Weill was always enamored with the idea of American culture. He was very much obsessed with American jazz, and he wanted to restart his life. And came to America with the intention of becoming an American composer. He wanted to leave Germany behind. He wanted to work in a different way.
So could this be considered a kind of a transitional thing for American theater, from coming from a classical kind of opera background into the vitality of the blues and jazz?
Exactly. He came to America at the same moment that Gershwin was trying to make the crossover. Gershwin had written a lot of popular musicals in the 1920s, but in the 1930s with something like Porgy and Bess, he was trying to create an opera idiom that would be accessible to a larger audience, that it would the idea of an American folk opera. And Weill arrives just about the time that Porgy and Bess is being written. So he had a model for this kind of thing. His early works in the U.S. Included an anti-war musical performed by the group theater called Johnny Johnson.
Yes.
And yes. And which was I don't know if it was a success, but it certainly had a certain amount of notoriety. His biggest success was a musical that he wrote with Maxwell Anderson called Knickerbocker Holiday, which is a play that deals with the early days of New York and the Peter Stuyvesant's dictatorial rule, and it's a left wing piece about totalitarianism and oppression, but done as a Broadway musical.
Yes.
And it had and like most of his shows, had a fantastic score. Probably the most famous tune from that piece is September Song. And he began to really make it a very strong impression as a musical theater composer, as a musical comedy composer, which is what he wanted to do. He was very interested to get his music out to the widest possible audience. This was always something that was very important to him. He didn't want to be part of the elite. Yes, he could write symphonies. Yes, he could write all kinds of different kinds of music. He wrote operetta when he was in Germany, things like that. But he really was interested in being a composer whose music was heard.
Well, what brought you to bring it to Muhlenberg?
Yeah.
25 years ago, I've been at Muhlenberg for 37 years. I had a wonderful collaboration with Jeremy Slavin, who was the director of vocal music at Muhlenberg, and we had a really strong group of students, and we thought, this would be an interesting piece to try to do with students. We were sort of out of our minds because it's a massive piece. Street Scene has a cast of 60.
Orchestra of 35.
And we have a 33 piece orchestra. You can't do the when we decided to do the production, one of the things that Weill did that's quite extraordinary is when he passed away, all the royalties from his works, which are considerable because he wrote Mack the Dife, which is one of the most popular songs ever written, all the royalties that come in from the production and performance of his works go into a foundation, which then go out to support performances of his works. And so we applied for a grant from the Weill Foundation, and this was 25 years ago, and they gave us some money. And with the idea, they said to us, you can have the money, but only if you use the full orchestra, because Weill was he was very much a European composer, and unlike any other Broadway composer, he did his own orchestrations, so he considers the orchestra a crucial part of the opera. And we are blessed In the Lehigh Valley, to have a wonderful group of musicians. So we're going to have a 33-piece professional orchestra. So Slavin and I did the show 25 years ago. Carol Silvoy, who's a very fine local performer, played the leading role. Steve Malloy, who is now on the faculty at Moravian Academy, played the other leading role. And we had a large student cast. Also, Tim Roach was in the production. In those days, the Muhlenberg Theater Department was considerably smaller than it is now. We have expanded considerably. We're about three or four times the size. So we were able to cast all the major roles with students, except the two leading roles, which are two older characters, which two of our voice professors, Ed Barra, who's he's an outstanding singer, and Lauren Kernow, who was a Muhlenberg grad. She graduated from Muhlenberg in 95. And she has had an international, she went to the Juilliard School, the Curtis Institute, and she had an international opera career. She's come back to the college now. She's on our voice faculty. She was a theater major when she was an undergraduate, and she's a fabulous actress. And so they are playing the two roles of Frank and Anna Morant. There's two sort of older leads, two younger leads, and the two younger leads are being played by two students, Joseph Marks and Samantha Simon.
And your musical director.
And my musical director, the reason why 25 years later we decided to do it is that Muhlenberg a few years ago brought on board a new director of vocal music after Slavin retired after being at Muhlenberg for 39 years. it was enough, and it was fine. And so Michael Schnack came to Muhlenberg. We are blessed to have him at Muhlenberg. He was the former director of the Musical Theater Training Institute in Vienna, Austria, and is very much involved with musical theater production, and he jumped at the chance to do this piece, and was really supportive. And he's and because it's an opera, it's really crucial of who the musical director is going to be. And I've done several productions now with Michael, and he's a meticulous musician and has really is really moving our students to an incredible place. This is not a piece that's generally performed in colleges. It's very vocally demanding, but the musical vocabulary of the piece is quite stunning, because on the one hand, there are parts of it that are just incredibly operatic, you know, major arias. There's at one point Mrs. Morant has a 7-minute aria where she sings straight for 7 minutes, and Lauren does a beautiful job.
We certainly do recommend this very highly to our audiences. We might remind everyone out there that it's Thursday, March 26th, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Please call the box office at muhlenberg.edu for more information. Incidentally, other than the performances itself, there's a Broadway stage recital and lecture, I understand.
Yes, on Saturday, this coming Saturday, in fact, at 2 p.m., in the recital hall in the Center for the Arts at Muhlenberg, Ed Barra and Lauren Kernow will be doing a recital of some of the music from the show and some other music that relates to the show.
Oh, nice.
We've gotten wonderful support from a variety of foundations for this production. It's been a huge financial undertaking, as you can imagine.
Yeah.
And part of that was doing community outreach for this, and it's a free recital. Mm-hmm. These are fabulous singers. It's going to be a lovely afternoon of opera, of opera highlights and highlights from the show.
And, of course, there's a master classes on Saturday, February the 21st. More information you can get to at muhlenberg.edu.
February
21st? No.
March. Where am I? Saturday, February 21st, right?
That was already took place.
Oh, it went. Oops. See, I wasn't there. But we could go again if you have it. Yeah. Street Scene Dramaturgical Presentation is also coming up.
On March 20th at 2 o'clock in the Center for the Arts.
This is fantastic. Thank you, Charles, for being with us. And we highly recommend everyone get to Muhlenberg to see this magnificent production. It's a must-see, I guarantee you. Coming up moments from now is Peterson Toscano, a queer, quirky Quaker, playfully exploring the serious world of gender, religion, and climate change. Right after this, Inescapable Message.
Do you have a car that you're trading in? How about an old truck or boat that's taking up space? Let WDIY help you get rid of unwanted vehicles and turn them into financial support for the station. It's a simple and easy process. We handle all the towing, title, and transfer, and you receive a tax deduction. Turn your vehicle into the programs you love on WDIY. To learn more, visit WDIY.org or call 610-694-8100, extension 7.
Thank you.
Welcome back. This is Lehigh Valley Art Salon, WDIY 88.1 in Allentown. And we are now chatting with Peterson Toscano, playwright, actor, Bible scholar, blogger, and gay activist. He is performing at the Citizens Climate Lobby of the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic Regional Conference on March 13th at Lehigh University. And, of course, the subject, climate change. What's faith got to do with it? He'll also be talking to us about other things.
Hi, Peterson. Welcome, and thank you for talking with us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's great. We're looking forward to the performance on Friday. A quick question, because we actually were theater folk ourselves. I understand that you started out when you were younger studying theater, and that you were performance, and you left that. Life took you in other directions, but it's apparently brought you back to performance. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey?
Yeah, you know, I love theater, and I went to City College in New York City to study theater, but there was a conflict in my life at the time, because as a person of faith, as a Christian, I really struggled with being gay, and I felt at the time that it was wrong, and it was wrong for me to be gay, and my pastor was insisting that it was also wrong, and I caved to that pressure, and the theater department that I was in was infested with homosexuals. and so I felt that I needed to lay it down. And so I just stopped all theater at about the age of 20 and didn't pick it up until almost 15 years later, when I came out gay and then began to find who I was again.
You know, could you talk a little bit about what in that journey, why then performance and particularly humor? I think, you know, I understand that. Well, I think when we address things that may make people uncomfortable, if they're concerned about or frightened of, whether it's a sexuality, climate change, that humor can be a safer or a more relaxing way into that conversation.
I think so too. I think also it physically it relaxes people. You know, when you laugh, it literally relaxes you. Mm-hmm. And there are some issues that people just automatically tense up around because of the way they've been spoken about in our society and because of fear. Fear changes the brain. So comedy helps to relax it. But then comedy also gives you the chance to get deadly honest and mm-hmm. serious about something. I mean, some of the best jokes are really about serious things. And the comedy isn't so much that people find it necessarily humorous, but they recognize a truth to it. And I love when that happens with a good joke, and people's insight is deepened because of it, regardless of what the issue is.
And it's interesting. You started out, I think, with performance, addressing your own journey, sexuality, self-acceptance. Where the kind of going over with climate change, the connection or the kind of focus on that? What prompted that?
It seems like they're completely unrelated. I mean, my first play was about how I spent 17 years trying to de-gay myself through conversion therapy. That play was called Doing Time in the Homo Nomo Halfway House. And then I did all this biblical scholarship looking at gender nonconforming Bible characters. A play called Transgressing Gender in the Bible, Transfigurations. And now I'm looking at climate change, a faith response to climate change, a queer response to climate change, and a new play called Does This Apocalypse Make Me Look Fat? And a lot of people would think, well, these things have nothing to do with each other. But in all the cases, actually they do. And it goes back to my childhood. I grew up in a very interesting family. All my aunts and uncles were non-Italian. My grandparents were Italian. And so I have cousins who are half black, half Puerto Rican, half Jewish. And I saw early on how people were treated differently, even within our own family, based on who they were. And it was completely racist at times. There was no doubt about it. It was classist. And we were all the same family, but we didn't get the same treatment. And then I noticed the same thing happened in the church when I was involved in, you know, conservative Christian churches. Depending on who you were, you had access to preach, you had the ability to be a missionary, or you were disqualified. Then I came out gay, and I was shocked to see how transphobic, how anti-transgender so many gays and lesbians were. And that just sort of gets to a core moral of mine that I just think, you know, people should be treated fairly. And then when I started looking at climate change, not from an environmentalist point of view, because I'm not really an environmentalist, mm-hmm. but I started looking at how it doesn't affect people equally. It affects women in the world more than men. It affects people of color and poor people more than white people and people with money. I thought, well, this is ridiculous. This is, you know, yet again another system. And I asked them, think about how, yeah, we're in the same boat together. Could be in the church, the LGBT community, climate change, but we're not all on the same deck. Some people are stuck in steerage class while other people are drinking martinis on the lifeboats. And it comes down to human rights and justice at that point.
Yes, I understand. You know, we listen to your podcasts, and they're absolutely fabulous.
Mm.
I know you mentioned that you weren't an environmentalist, but, of course, I think you agree that it's the biggest social justice issue facing the world today.
It is, and that's why I think we need to wrestle it out of the hands of just an environmentalist issue, because there's a lot of people don't identify as being an environmentalist.
Mm-hmm.
And this really is about people. It's about food security. It's about political stability. It's about a lot of these things that sure, the environment will impact those things, but it's more than just about polar bears on an ice floe.
Yes.
It's really about people's lives today.
I love your quote. It's not just about polar bears and heterosexuals anymore.
Actually, and just to mention for our listeners, the podcast is called Climate Sue.
That's correct.
On your website. And which brings me back again to, I'm intrigued, you know, things of social justice, things like this can also make for very bad theater.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, sadly. And I think a lot of us are really interested in how we can bring the arts to this issue in a way that's useful and still not be bad art. Can you tell us a little bit for the audiences in the Lehigh Valley, if they're coming to the show or the performance on Friday evening, what's your take into this? How do you take us into this, and how do you bring us into the conversation with you?
Well, for one, I'm a character actor, so when I'm on stage, I'll talk as myself at times, but often I will then go into a variety of characters, as I do on the podcast, mm-hmm. And so most of those voices are me doing these various characters, and when I do a character, I'm not simply interested in whatever their message is. I'm really interested in the character. It's character-driven work, and when you're mixing message, political message, social justice message with art, it is so easy to make it clunky, wooden, overburdened, didactic mess. And I think you have to be willing to be subtle at times. Mm. You need to be willing to have people get so caught up in the moment and the character that they actually might miss the point, but they'll come away with something else, and that's fine. This is difficult when you go to an organization and they say, well, what is your main point going to be? And then you have to say, well, it depends on the audience member, really. It's what they get out of it. Because when it's really good art, people will draw from it. And so I use lots of metaphors. So I'll talk about, you know, my parents who both died of lung cancer. I talk about that at times in my work as a real metaphor about climate change, even though I'll never mention the word climate change in that whole monologue. Because I think we need to find human experiences that we can relate to, and that's what makes good art. And if people are moved, even if they're not moved to action the way that I would like them to be moved to action, that's fine, because as an artist, I just want them to be moved.
Mm-hmm. The title of the piece was Climate Change, What's Faith Got to Do With It? And I know you've been on a journey of faith. You're a Quaker at this point.
That's right.
And where does faith intersect in this for you, particularly in the performance or in that performance conversation?
Well, in this presentation I'll be doing on the 13th, I really will look at that intersection because, you know, you think of, for one, faith organizations, churches, mosques, synagogues, whatever faith organizations in the world, they have such a huge body of people, and they're very organized. And for them to be engaged in climate change from their own perspective is very powerful, because you have a lot of people very organized in that regards. And I think sometimes people disengage. They think that, like, science and faith are at odds with each other. And so the two can't come together. But I think by exploring that through comedy, and also exploring it through my own personal journey as a born-again evangelical Christian that I was for many years and now as a Quaker, I think we can find, again, metaphors from Bible stories, from faith experiences that really connect very well with the climate story. And that even there are Bible stories that have climate elements. Joseph in Egypt, he could become second in command because he somewhat predicts climate change for his time and comes up with a plan to adapt. And I think there's stories, ancient stories that we have a lot of confidence in, you know, from having them around for a long time, that they speak to us. And I think in those stories, we can find messages that make sense for us today.
That's interesting, because I think in having listened to, you know, again, your podcasts or interviews, it strikes me that you're also at that place in the stages of grief or denial or whatever, where you're talking also about how we be with that world and live in that world, that where climate change is simply is happening, but how do we be with it? Would that be a fair take on?
That's right. And what's desperately needed are people to have a vision for the future, one that is not simply averting catastrophe, but one that really is looking at creating a better world. And I think people of faith and faith communities traditionally have been very good at that sort of thing at times, not always, for sure. And we are at a time in history that we need hope, we need comfort, and we need ritual. I mean, I really do believe that lots of people are going through grief. The planet that we live on today is very different from the one that many of us were born on, and it's changing over our heads and under our feet, and that is disturbing. Mm-hmm. And to be able to address that and to have ritual to experience some of that grief so that we can move through it, I think is so, so vital. And again, I think the place of art is a really good place to do that by modeling it on stage, either through character or as myself, helping people see what that's like and to see what it's like to raise those questions like, what is my role on a new planet? Mm. I think that's a really important, deep spiritual question for folks to be asking these days.
Unfortunately, I think we're going to be saying goodbye soon, but to remind the listening audience, it's Friday the 13th, 7 p.m. at Neville Hall at Lehigh University. Climate change, what's faith got to do with it? With Peterson Toscano, George?
March 13th through the 15th is the Citizens Climate Lobby Conference, and there's a lot going on, but make sure you catch Peterson on March 13th at 7 o'clock.
And Peterson, just to point out, you are a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby and strongly supportive of the organization, yes.
That's right, yeah. Yes. In Sunbury, Pennsylvania, my husband and I are the co-leaders of probably the smallest chapter of this group in America.
We thank you very much, Peterson.
Thank you so much.
Next up on Lehigh Valley Art Salon, at the movies, a review of a current film with Paul Willistine of The Press.
Okay, the series season of Oscar nominees and recipients is over. It's time for some guilty pleasure. 50 Shades of Grey? No. The SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water. SpongeBob SquarePants, which began on Nickelodeon in 1999, was one of the Saturday morning TV animated film rituals for my son Elias and myself. We also enjoyed the movie, the SpongeBob SquarePants movie, released in 2004, which we most likely saw at our favorite Lehigh Valley downtown first-run movie theater, Bethlehem's late lamented Boyd Theater. I like it when the curtain opens, a young Elias would remark. Elias is a student at Moravian College. He's a senior, and his chemistry major, environmental sciences minor classes, and tutoring and campus activities keep his schedule very busy. Plus, he didn't really want to see the SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water. Movie maven Mike, Michael Gonkowski of Whitehall, didn't want to see the SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water, either. So here I am, sitting alone in the multiplex as the previews unreal, awaiting with, yes, anticipation to see the movie that knocked American Sniper from its perch at number one. The SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water, was seen in the 2D format, although there are some nifty time travel scenes that would appear to be dazzling in 3D. The plot in the SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water, is simple and familiar. Plankton wants to steal the secret formula for Krabby Patty from the Krusty Krab restaurant in Bikini Bottom. If that's not enough, a pirate named Burger Beard, played by Antonio Banderas, also wants to steal the secret formula. The SpongeBob movie, Sponge Out of Water, is a fun combination of the simple hand-drawn animation style that typifies a SpongeBob TV show, and live action and stop motion animation. The SpongeBob movie Sponge Out of Water is directed by Paul Tibbett. He's the producer-writer of the SpongeBob TV series and the first SpongeBob movie. The screenplay is by Glenn Berger and Jonathan Eibel. They co-wrote Kung Fu Panda and its sequel. And it's from a story by Tibbett and Steven Hillenburg. He's the creator of SpongeBob SquarePants. The screenplay is replete with bad puns, so many so that in one scene there is actually a rock band named Bad Puns, with a Z, which provides a rim shot after a particular groaner. Speaking of the movie's time travel machine, I felt as though I was 10 again. I think my son Elias and movie maven Mike would have enjoyed the SpongeBob movie Sponge Out of Water. I think you will too. The SpongeBob movie Sponge Out of Water is MPAA rated PG for mild action and rude humor. Opening March 13 are Cinderella. Kenneth Branagh directs Lily James, Haley Atwell, and Helena Bonham Carter in the live-action version of the Disney animation classic based on the fairy tale. Run All Night. This month's family victim in peril thriller starring Liam Neeson has to do with an aging hitman who takes on his former boss to protect his family. Janessa Rodriguez, Joel Kinnaman, and Vincent D'Onofrio co-star. It Follows. A 19-year-old girl is plagued by the sense that she's being followed. Meka Monroe, Keir Gilchrist, Olivia Liccardi, and Lily